Medical examiner had shaved the victim's head in the vicinity of the wounds. A ruler had been placed in the photo to give dimension. On the skin, the impacts were pinkish and circular. The skin was broken, but the blood had been washed away to show the wounds. Two overlapped, and the third was only an inch away. The circular shape of the weapon's impact surface led me to think that Bondurant had been attacked with a hammer. I'm not much of a home fix-it man, but I know my way around a toolbox, and I knew that the striking surface of many hammers was circular, something ovoid. I was sure this would be confirmed by the coroner's tool mark expert, but it was always good to be a step ahead and anticipate their moves. I noticed that there was a small V-shaped notch in each of the impact marks and wasn't sure what it meant. I checked the search warrant return again and saw that the police had not listed a hammer among the tools seized from Lisa Trammell's garage. This was curious because so many other less common tools were seized. Again, it may have been because the search was carried out before the autopsy was conducted and such facts were known. The police took all tools, rather than a specific tool. It still left the question, though. Where was the hammer? Was there a hammer? This, of course, was the case's first double-edged sword. The prosecution would hold that the lack of a hammer in a fully stocked workbench was an indication of culpability. The defendant used the hammer to strike and kill the victim, then discarded it to hide her involvement in the crime. The defense's side of that argument was that the missing hammer was exculpatory. You have no murder weapon, you have no connection to the defendant, you have no case. On paper, it should be a wash, but not always. Jurors typically lean toward the prosecution in such questions. Call it the home field advantage. The prosecution is always the home team. Still, I made a note to tell Sisko to chase down the hammer as best he could. Talk to Lisa Trammell, see what she knew. Track down her husband, if only to ask if there ever was a hammer and what had happened to it. The next photos from the autopsy were of the shattered skull itself after the scalp had been pulled back over the cranium. The damage was extensive, the skull having been punctured by all three of the blows and fractured in almost wave-like patterns emanating from the impact areas. The wounds were described as unsurvivable, and the photos completely backed this conclusion. The autopsy listed several other lacerations and abrasions on the body, and even a fracture as well as three broken teeth. But the examiner interpreted all of these as injuries sustained when Bondurant fell face forward to the ground during the attack. He was unconscious, if not already dead, before he hit the garage floor. There were no defensive wounds listed. Part of the autopsy protocol contained color photocopies of the crime scene photos provided to the examiner by the LAPD. It was not a complete set, but just six shots that showed the body's orientation in situ, meaning situated as it had been found. I would have rather had a full set of prints of the actual photographs, but I wouldn't get those until I got a judge to ease the discovery embargo placed on the case by Andy Freeman. The crime scene photos showed Bondurant's body from numerous angles. It was sprawled between two cars in the garage. The driver's side door of a Lexus SUV was open. There was a Joe's Joe coffee cup on the ground and a pool of spilled coffee. Nearby was an open briefcase. Bondurant was face down on the ground, the back and top of his head matted with blood. His eyes were open and appeared to be staring at concrete. In the photos, there were evidence markers next to blood drips on the concrete. There was no analysis to determine if this was blood spatter from the attack itself or drippings from the murder weapon. I found the briefcase to be a curious thing. Why was it open? Had anything been taken? Had the murderer taken the time to rifle through the case after killing Bondurant? If so, this would seem to be a cold and calculated move. The garage was filling with employees coming to work at the bank. To take the time to go through a briefcase while the body of your victim lies nearby seemed like an extreme risk, but not the sort of move a killer fueled by emotion and vengeance would make. It was not the move of an amateur. I wrote a few more notes in regard to these questions, and then a final reminder. I would have Sisko find out if there was assigned parking in the garage. Did Bondurant have his name on the wall at the front of the stall? The lying-in-wait tag, added to the murder charge, indicated the prosecution believed Trammell knew where Bondurant would be and when. They would have to prove that at trial. I closed the Trammell files and wrapped a rubber band around them and the legal pad. You doing okay? I asked Haley. Sure. Are you almost finished? My food or my homework? Both. I'm finished eating, but I still have social studies in English. But we can go if you want. I still have a few other files to look at. I have court tomorrow. For the murder case? No, other cases. Like where you're trying to let people stay in their houses? That's right. How come there are so many cases like that? Out of the mouths of babes. Greed, honey. It all comes down to greed on everybody's part. I looked at her to see if that would suffice, but she didn't go back to her homework. She looked at me expecting more. A 14-year-old who was interested in what most of the country was not. Well, what happens is that it takes a lot of money to buy a house or a condo most of the time. That's why so many people rent their homes instead. Most people who buy a home put down a big chunk of money, but they almost never have enough to buy the whole house, so they go to the bank for a loan. The bank decides if they have enough money and make enough money to pay back the loan, which is called a mortgage. So if everything looks good, they buy the home they want and pay back the mortgage with monthly payments for many years. Does this make sense? You mean like they pay rent to the bank? Sort of. But when you rent from a landlord, you don't get any ownership. There is supposed to be ownership involved when you have a mortgage. It is your home, and they say the American dream is to own your own home. Do you own yours? I do. And your mom owns hers. She nodded, but I wasn't so sure we were talking at a level understandable to a 14-year-old. She didn't see much of the American dream in her parents having separate mortgages to go with their separate addresses. Okay, so a while back, they started making it easier to buy a home. And soon, practically anybody who walked into a bank or went to see a mortgage broker was being given a loan on a home. There was a lot of fraud and corruption, and there were a lot of loans given to people who shouldn't have been given them. Some people lied to get loans, and sometimes it was the loan makers who lied. We're talking about millions of loans, hey. And when you have that much going on, there are not enough people or rules to control it all. Was it like nobody made anybody pay? There was some of that, but it was mostly that people were taking on more than they could handle. And these loans had interest rates that changed. These rates dictated how much the homeowner had to pay each month, and they could go up by a lot. Sometimes they had what's called a balloon payment, where you have to pay it all back at the end of 5 years. To make a long and complicated story short, the country's economy went down, and the values of the homes went down with it. It became a crisis because millions of people in the country couldn't pay for the houses they bought, and they couldn't sell them because they were worth less than what was owed on them. But the banks and other lenders and these investment syndicates that held all the mortgages didn't really care about that. They just wanted their money back. So when people couldn't pay, they started taking their houses. So those people hire you. Some of them do. But there are millions of foreclosures going on. These lenders all want their money back, and so some of them do bad things. And some of them hire people to do bad things. They lie and cheat and they take away people's houses without doing it fairly or under the law. And that's where I come in. I looked at her. I had probably lost her already. I pulled over the second stack of files I had on the table and opened the top one. I spoke as I read. Okay, now here's one. This family bought a house 6 years ago, and the monthly payment was $900. 2 years later, when the shit started to hit the... Dad? Sorry. 2 years later, when things started going wrong in this country, their interest rate went up, and so did their payment. At the same time, the husband lost his job as a school bus driver because he had an accident. So the husband and wife went to the bank and said, "Hey, we have a problem. Can we change or restructure our loan so we can still pay for our house?" This is called loan modification, and it's pretty much a joke. These people did the right thing going in like that, but the bank led them on and said, "Yes, we'll work with you. You keep paying what you can while we go to work on this." So they paid what they could, but it wasn't enough. They waited and waited, but they never heard anything from the bank. That is, until they got the notice in the mail that they were being foreclosed on. So it's this kind of stuff that is wrong, and I try to do something about it. It's David and Goliath stuff, hey. The giant financial institutions are running roughshod over people, and they don't have too many guys like me standing up for them. It was during my explanation to my young daughter that I finally realized why I had been drawn to this particular practice of law. Yes, some of my clients were just gaming the system. They were charlatans, no better than the banks they were taking on. But some of my clients were the downtrodden and disadvantaged. They were the true underdogs in society, and I wanted to stand for them and keep them in their homes for as long as I possibly could. Haley had raised her pencil and was itching to go back to work as soon as I dismissed her. She was polite that way and must have gotten it from her mother. Anyway, that's what it's all about. You can go back to work now. You want something else to drink or a dessert? Dad, pancakes are like dessert. She had braces and had chosen lime green bands. When she spoke, my attention was constantly drawn to her teeth. Oh, right, yeah. Then what about something else to drink? More milk? No, I'm fine. Okay. I went back to work, too, and separated the 3 foreclosure files in front of me. I had been getting so much business off the radio ads that we had been bundling court appearances. That is, trying to schedule together hearings and appearances on all cases that I had before a particular judge. In the morning, I had 3 hearings before Judge Alfred Byrne in the downtown county courthouse. All 3 were defenses based on claims of wrongful foreclosure and fraud perpetrated by the lender or the loan servicing agent employed by the lender. In each of the cases, I had stayed foreclosure with my court filings. My clients were in their homes and not required to make their monthly payments. The other side viewed this as a scam equal in size to the foreclosure epidemic. I was despised by opposing counsel for perpetuating fraud myself and only delaying an inevitable outcome. That was okay by me. When you come from the criminal defense bar, you're used to being despised. Am I too late for pancakes? I looked up to see my ex-wife slide into the booth next to our daughter. She landed a kiss on Haley's cheek before the girl could go on the defensive. She was at that age. I wished Maggie had slid into my side of the booth and planted one on me. But I could wait. I smiled at her as I started pulling all the files off the table to make room. "It's never too late for pancakes," I said. Chapter 8. Lisa Trammell was formally arraigned in Van Nuys the following Tuesday. It was a routine hearing, intended to put her plea on record and to start the clock in order to meet the state's speedy trial requirement. However, because my client was free on bail, we would likely be waiving speedy trial. There was no reason to hurry as long as she was breathing free air. The case would slowly build momentum like a summer storm and begin when the defense was fully prepared. But the arraignment did serve the purpose of putting Lisa's forthright and emphatic not guilty on the court record, as well as on video for the gathered media. Though attendance was lower than it was at her first appearance, because the national media tends to retreat from the ongoing mundane processes of a case as it passes through the justice system, the local media still showed in force, and the 15-minute hearing was well documented. The case had been assigned to Superior Court Judge Dario Morales for arraignment and preliminary hearing. The latter would be a perfunctory rubber stamping of the charges. Lisa would undoubtedly be held to answer, and the case would then be assigned to another judge for the main event, the trial. Though I had talked to her on the phone almost daily since her arrest, I had not seen Lisa in more than a week. She had declined my invitations to meet in person, and now I knew why. She looked like a different woman when she showed up in court. Her hair had been cut into a stylish wave, and her face looked both excessively pink and smooth. Whispers in the courtroom hinted that Lisa had had a Botox facial treatment in order to become more visually appealing. I believed these physical changes, as well as the smart new suit Lisa was wearing, were the work of Herb Dahl. He and Lisa seemed inseparable, and Dahl's involvement was becoming more and more troubling. He had begun incessantly referring producers and screenwriters to my office number. This left Lorna constantly deflecting their attempts to secure a piece of the Lisa Trammell story. Quick checks of the Internet Movie Database usually revealed these Herb Dahl referrals to be Hollywood hacks and bottom feeders of the lowest caliber. It wasn't that we couldn't use a nice big infusion of Hollywood cash to defray our mounting costs, but these were all deal now, pay later people, and that wouldn't do. Meantime, my own agent was out there trying to sew up a deal with an upfront fee that would cover a few salaries and the rent on an office, and still leave enough to pay back Dahl and make him go away. With almost any court hearing, the most important information and actions are not what ends up on the record. So too with Lisa's arraignment. After her plea was routinely put on record, and Morales scheduled a status hearing for 2 weeks later, I told the judge that the defense had a number of motions to submit to the court for consideration. He welcomed them, and I stepped forward and handed his clerk 5 separate motions. I gave Andrea Freeman copies as well. The first 3 motions had been prepared by Aronson after her in-depth review of the LAPD's search warrant application, the video of Detective Curlin interviewing Lisa Trammell, and the questions regarding Miranda and when Lisa was actually placed under arrest. Aronson had found inconsistencies, procedural errors, and exaggerations of fact. She drew up motions to suppress, asking that the taped interview be disallowed in the case, and that all evidence gathered from the search of the defendant's home be excluded as well. The motions were well thought out and cogently written. I was proud of Aronson and pleased with myself for seeing her as a diamond in the rough when her resume had crossed my desk. But the truth was, I knew her motions didn't stand much of a chance. No judge elected to the bench wants to throw out the evidence in a murder case. Not if he wants the voting public to keep him on the bench. So the jurist will look for ways to maintain status quo and get the decisions on evidence before a jury. Nevertheless, Aronson's motions played an important role in the defense strategy, because accompanying them were 2 other motions. One sought to jumpstart the discovery process by requesting defense access to all records and internal memoranda pertaining to Lisa Trammell and Mitchell Bondurant held by Westland Financial. The other was a motion compelling the prosecution to allow the defense to examine Trammell's laptop computer, cell phone, and all personal documents seized in the search of her home. Since Morales would want to act equitably toward both the defense and prosecution, my strategy was to push the judge toward a Solomonic solution. Split the baby. Dismiss the motions to suppress, but give the defense the access requested in the other 2 motions. Of course, both Morales and Freeman had been around the block a few times and would see this strategy coming from a mile away. Still, just because they knew what I was doing didn't mean they could stop it. Besides that, I had a 6th motion in my pocket that I had not yet filed with the court, and it was going to be my ace in the hole. Morales gave Freeman 10 days to respond to the motions and adjourned the hearing, quickly moving on to his next case. A good judge always keeps the cases moving. I turned to Lisa and told her to wait for me in the hallway because I was going to speak to the prosecutor. I noticed Dahl waiting for her at the gate. He would be more than happy to escort her out. I decided to deal with him later and went over to the prosecution table. Freeman had her head down and was writing a note on a legal pad. "Hey, Andy?" She looked up at me. She had just begun to smile, expecting to see some friend who typically called her Andy. When she saw it was me, the smile disappeared in an instant. I placed the 6th motion down on the table in front of her. "Take a look at that when you have a minute. I'm going to file it tomorrow morning. Didn't want to inundate the court with a blizzard of paper today, you know? Tomorrow morning should be fine, but I thought I'd give you a heads up since it involves you." "Me? What are you talking about?" I didn't answer. I left her there and made my way through the gate and out of the courtroom. As I stepped through the double doors, I saw my client and Herb Dahl already holding court in front of a deep semicircle of reporters and cameras. I quickly walked up behind Lisa, took her by the arm, and pulled her away while she was in mid-sentence.
That's all, folks,
I said in my best Porky Pig. Lisa struggled against my pull, but I still managed to get her away from the pack and start walking her down the hallway.
What are you doing? She protested. You are embarrassing me.
Embarrassing you? Lisa, you are embarrassing yourself with that guy. I told you to drop him. Now look at you, all done up like you're some kind of movie star. This is a trial, Lisa, not Entertainment Tonight.
I was telling them my story.
I stopped walking when we were far enough away from the crowd not to be overheard. Lisa, you can't talk openly to the media like that. It can come back to bite you on the ass.
What are you talking about? It was a perfect opportunity to give my side of this. I'm being railroaded here, and it's time to speak out. I told you, it's guilty people who don't speak.
The problem is, the DA has a media unit, and they copy and record every story about you that is printed and aired. Everything you say, they have a copy of it. And if you ever change your story even slightly from one statement to the next, then they've got you. They'll crucify you with it in front of a jury. What I'm trying to say is it's not worth the risk, Lisa. You should let me do the talking for you. But if you can't do that and really want to put out your story yourself, then we'll prepare and rehearse you and plan it with strategic hits in the media.
But that's where Herb comes in. He was making sure I didn't...
Let me explain it again to you, Lisa. Herb Dahl is not your attorney and does not have your best interests as his priority. He has Herb Dahls, okay? I can't seem to get the message through to you. You have to cut him loose. He...
No, I can't. I won't. He's the only one who truly cares.
Oh, that's really breaking my heart, Lisa. If he's the only one who cares about you, what's he doing still talking to those people? I pointed to the knot of reporters and photographers. Sure enough, Dahl was still holding forth, feeding them whatever they needed.
What is he saying to them, Lisa? Do you know? Because I sure as shit don't. And that's sort of funny because you're the defendant and I'm the defense attorney. Who's he?
He can speak for me, Lisa said. As we watched Dahl pointing his finger to call on reporters, I saw the door to the courtroom we had just left swing open. Andrea Freeman strode out, holding my sixth motion in her hand, her eyes scanning the hallway. At first she zeroed in on the media knot, but then she saw it was not me at the center of it. When her radar picked me up, she corrected her course and made a beeline right toward me. A few of the reporters called to her, but she sharply waved them off with the document. Lisa, go over to one of those benches and sit down and wait for me, and don't talk to any reporters.
What about just do it?
As Lisa walked away, Freeman came up on me. She was mad, and I could see the fire in her eyes.
What is this shit, Holler?
She held up the paper. I maintained a calm demeanor, even as she stepped right into my personal space.
Well, I said, I think it's pretty obvious what it is. It's a motion to have you dismissed from the case because you have a conflict of interest.
I have a conflict of interest. What conflict?
Look, Andy, I can call you Andy, right? I mean, my daughter does, so I should too, don't you think?
Cut the shit, Holler.
Sure, I can do that.
The conflict that I'm objecting to is that you have been discussing this case with my ex-wife and...
Who happens to be a prosecutor working in the same office as me?
That's true, but these discussions haven't taken place in the office exclusively. In fact, they've taken place at yoga and in front of my daughter and probably all over the valley as far as I know.
Oh, come on. This is such bullshit.
Really? Then why did you lie to me?
I've never lied. What are you...
I asked you if you knew my ex-wife, and you said in passing.
That's not really the truth, is it?
I just didn't want to get into it with you.
So you lied. I didn't mention that in the motion, but I could add it before I file it. The judge could decide if it is important. She blew out her breath in agitated surrender.
What do you want?
I looked around. No one could hear us. What do I want? I want to show you that I can play it your way, too. You want to be a hard ass with me?
I can be one with you. Meaning what, Holler? What's the quid pro quo? I nodded. We were getting down to the deal now. You know if I file this tomorrow, you are history. The judge will err on the side of the defense. He'll avoid anything that might have any chance of getting him reversed. Besides, he knows there are 300 able-bodied prosecutors in the DA's office. They can just send in a replacement. I pointed to the gaggle of reporters assembled in the hall, most of them still surrounding Herb Dahl. You see all of those reporters and all that attention? All of that will go away. Probably the biggest case of your career, and it all goes away. No press conferences, no headlines, no spotlight. It all goes to whoever they send in to take your place. First of all, I will fight this thing, and it is not a given that Judge Morales will fall for your bullshit. I would tell him exactly what you were doing, trying to DA shop, trying to get rid of a prosecutor that you are flat-out scared of. You can tell him all you like, but you'll still have to tell the judge, in open court, how it is that my 14-year-old daughter was reciting facts of this case back to me at dinner last week. That is bullshit. You should be ashamed of using your... What, are you saying that I'm the liar or my daughter is the liar? Because we could bring her into court, too. I'm not so sure your bosses are going to like the spectacle this will cause, or the headlines. You know, D.A. grills 14-year-old, calls the kid a liar. Kind of tawdry, don't you think? Freeman turned her back and took a step to walk away from me, but then stopped. I knew I had her. She should walk away from me and the case, but she couldn't. She wanted the case and all that it could bring her. She turned back to me. She looked at me as though I were not even there, as if I were dead. Again, what do you want? I'd rather not file this tomorrow. I'd rather just withdraw the motions I had to make to get my client's property back and to see the Westland documents. All I want is cooperation, a friendly give and take on discovery. I want it to start flowing now, not later. I don't want to go to the judge every time I want something I'm entitled to. I could complain to the bar about you. Good. We can make cross-complaints. They'll investigate both of us and find that only you acted inappropriately by discussing the case with defense counsel's ex-wife and daughter. I didn't discuss it with your daughter. She was just there. I'm sure the bar will make that distinction. I let her twist for a moment. It was her move, but she needed one final push. Oh, and by the way, if I file the motion tomorrow, I'll be sure to drop a dime to the Times. Who's their court reporter? Salters? I think she'd find this to be an interesting little side story. A nice exclusive. She nodded, as though her predicament had just become crystal clear in front of her. Withdraw your motions, she said. You will have everything you asked for by the end of the day Friday. Tomorrow. That's not enough time. I have to pull it together and get it copied. The copy shop is always backed up. Then Thursday by noon, or I file the motion. Fine, asshole. Good. Once I go through it all, maybe we can start talking about a plea. Thank you, Andy. Fuck you, Holler. And there isn't going to be a plea. We've got her nailed, and I'm going to be looking at you, not her, when the verdict comes in. She pivoted and started to walk away, but then turned right back to me. And don't call me Andy. You don't get to call me that. She marched away then, moving in long, angry strides toward the elevator lobby, totally ignoring a reporter who trotted up to her and tried to get a quote. I knew there would be no plea agreement. My client wouldn't allow it, but I gave Freeman the opening so she could throw it back in my face. I wanted her to go away angry, but not that angry. I wanted her to think she had salvaged something. It would make her easier to deal with. I looked around and saw Lisa waiting dutifully on the bench I had earlier pointed her to. I signaled her to get up. Okay, Lisa, let's get out of here. But what about Herb? I drove in with him. Your car or his? His. Then he's fine. My guy will drive you home. We walked into the elevator alcove. Thankfully, Andrea Freeman had already caught a ride down to the DA's office on the second floor. I pushed the button, but the elevator didn't come soon enough. We were joined by Dahl.
What? Were you leaving without me?
I didn't respond to his question and quickly dispensed with any guise of civility.
You know, you're fucking me up by talking to the media like that. You think you're helping the cause, but you're not, unless Herbert Dahl is the cause.
Whoa, what's with the language? We're in a courthouse.
I don't care where we are. Do not speak for my client. Do you understand? If you do it again, I'm going to call a press conference, and you're not going to like what I have to say about you.
Fine. That was it. My last press conference. But now I got a question. What's going on with all these people I've been sending your way? Some of them called me back and said they were treated pretty rudely by your staff.
Yeah, you keep sending them, and we'll keep treating them that way. Hey, I know the business, and these are legitimate people.
The grind side?
Dahl looked confused. He looked at Lisa, and then back at me.
What's that mean?
The grind side. Come on, you mean you haven't heard of the grind side?
You mean the blind side? The movie about the lady who adopts the football player?
No, I mean the grind side. The movie made by one of the producers you sent over to us. It's about this lady who adopts a football player, and then has sex with him 3 or 4 times a day. Then when that gets boring, she invites the whole football team over. I don't think it made as much money as the blind side.
Lisa was turning pale. I got the feeling that what I was saying about Dahl's Hollywood connections wasn't matching up with what Dahl had been putting in her ears for weeks.
Yeah, this is what he's doing for you, Lisa. These are the kind of people he wants to put you with.
Look, Dahl said, do you have any idea how hard it is to get something going in this town? A project?
There are those who can and those who can't.
I don't care what the guy made before as long as he can get something going now. You understand? These are legitimate people, and I have a lot of money on the line here, Holler.
An elevator finally arrived. I directed Lisa onto it, but then put my hand on Dahl's chest and slowly pushed him away from the door.
Just back off, Dahl. You'll get your money and then some, but you just back off.
I stepped into the elevator and turned to make sure Dahl didn't attempt to jump on at the last moment. He didn't try it, but he didn't move either. I held his hateful stare until the doors closed on it.
Chapter 9. We moved into our new offices on Saturday morning. It was a 3-room suite in a building at Victory and Van Nuys Boulevards. The place was even called the Victory Building, which I liked. It was also fully furnished, and only 2 blocks from the courthouse where Lisa Trammell would face trial. All hands were on deck to help with the move, including Rojas, who wore a t-shirt and baggies, showing off the tattoos that completely covered his arms and legs. I didn't know which was more shocking, seeing the tattoos or seeing Rojas in anything other than the suit he always wore while driving me. The setup in the new place was that I got my own office, while Cisco and Aronson shared the other, larger office, and Lorna anchored the reception area in between. Going from the back seat of a Lincoln to an office with 10-foot ceilings, a full desk, and a nap couch was a big change. The first thing I did upon settling in was use the open space and polished wood floor to spread out the 800-plus pages of discovery documents I'd received from Andrea Freeman. Most of it was from Westland, and a lot of it was filler. It was Freeman's passive-aggressive response to being maneuvered by the defense. There were dozens of pages and packets on bank policy and procedures and other forms I didn't need. These all went into one pile. There were also copies of all communications that went directly to Lisa Trammell, most of which I already had and was familiar with. These went into a second pile. And finally, there were copies of internal bank communications as well as communications between the victim, Mitchell Bondurant, and the outside company the bank used to carry out its foreclosures. This company was called Aloft, and I was already quite familiar with it because it was my adversary on at least a third of my foreclosure cases. Aloft was a mill, a company that filed and tracked all documents required in the lengthy foreclosure process. It was a go-between that allowed bankers and other lenders to keep their hands clean in the dirty business of taking people's homes away from them. Companies like Aloft got the job done without the bank so much as having to send a letter to the customer faced with foreclosure. It was this stack of correspondence that I was most interested in, and it was here that I found the document that would change the course of the case. I moved behind my desk, sat down, and studied the phone. There were more buttons on it than I would ever have use for. I finally found the intercom button for the other office and pushed it. Hello? Nothing. I pushed it again. Cisco. Bullocks, are you there? Nothing. I got up and started toward the door, intent on communicating with my staff the old-fashioned way, when a response finally came over the phone speaker. Mickey, is that you? It was Cisco's voice. I hurried back to the desk and pushed the button. Yeah, it's me. Can you come in here and bring Bullocks? Roger and out. A few minutes later, my investigator and associate counsel entered. Hey, boss? Cisco asked, looking at the stacks of documents on the floor. The point of the office is to put stuff in drawers and file cabinets and up on shelves. I'll get around to it, I said. Shut the door and have a seat. Once we were all in place, I looked at them across my big rented desk and laughed. This is weird, I said. I could get used to it, having an office, Cisco said. But Bullocks doesn't know from nothing.
Yes, I do, Aronson protested. Last summer I interned at Chandler, Massey, and Ortiz, and I had my own office.
Well, maybe next time you get your own with us, I said. So now, down to business. Cisco, did you get the laptop to your guy? Yeah, dropped it off yesterday morning. I told him it was a rush job. We were talking about Lisa's laptop, which had been returned by the DA's office along with her cell phone and the four boxes of documents. And he's going to be able to tell us what the DA was looking at? He said he'll be able to provide a list of the files they opened and how long they were opened. From that, we should be able to get an idea of what they paid attention to. But don't get your hopes up. Why? Because Freeman gave in on this way too easily. I don't think she would have given us back the computer if it was that important to her. Maybe. Neither he nor Aronson were aware of the deal I made with Freeman or the leverage I had used. I turned my attention to Aronson. After she completed the motions to suppress earlier in the week, I had put her on backgrounding the victim. This came after Cisco had picked up some preliminary indications in his investigations that all was not well in Mitchell Bondurant's personal world. Bullocks, what have you got in our victim?
Well, there's still a lot I need to check out, but there's no doubt that he was heading over the falls, financially that is.
How so?
Well, when the going was good and the financing came easy, he was a definite player in the real estate market. Between 02 and 07, he bought and flipped 21 properties, mostly residential real estate, made good money, and plowed it back into bigger deals. Then the economy tanked and he was caught holding the bag.
He was upside down?
Exactly. At the time of his death, he owned 5 large properties that suddenly weren't worth what he had paid for them. It looks like he had been trying to sell them for more than a year. No takers. And 3 of them had balloons that were going to pop this year. It added up to over $2 million he would owe.
I stood up and came around the desk. I started pacing. Aronson's report was exciting. I didn't know exactly how it fit in, but I was confident I could make it fit. We just had to talk it out. Okay, so Bondurant, the senior vice president in charge of the home loan side of Westland, was falling victim to the same sort of situation as many of the people he was foreclosing on. When the money was flowing, he took mortgages with 5-year balloon notes, thinking like everybody else that he'd turn the properties over or remortgage long before the 5 years were up.
Except the economy goes into the toilet, Aronson said. He can't sell them, and he can't remortgage them because they aren't worth what he paid for them. No bank would touch his paper, not even his own.
Aronson had a glum look on her face. This is all good work, Bullocks. What's wrong?
Well, I'm just wondering what all this has to do with the murder.
Maybe nothing. Maybe everything. I went back to the desk and sat down. I handed her the 3-page document I had found in the volumes the prosecution had provided. She took it and held it so she and Cisco could both look at it.
What's this?
She asked.
I think it's our smoking gun. I forgot my glasses in the other office, Sisko said. Read it, Bullocks.
It's a copy of a certified letter from Bondurant to Louis Aparicio at A. Louis Aparicio Financial Technologies, or ALOFT for short. It says, Dear Louis, attached you will find correspondence from an attorney named Michael Haller who is representing the homeowner in one of the foreclosure cases you are handling for Westland. It gives Lisa's name, loan number, and the address of the house. Then it goes, In his letter, Mr. Haller makes allegations that the file is replete with fraudulent actions perpetrated in the case. You will note that he gives specific instances, all of which were carried out by ALOFT. As you know, and we have discussed, there have been other complaints. These new allegations against ALOFT, if true, have put Westland in a vulnerable position, especially considering the government's recent interest in this aspect of the mortgage business. Unless we come to some sort of arrangement and understanding in regard to this, I will be recommending to the board that Westland withdraw from its contract with your company for cause and any ongoing business be terminated. This action would also require the bank to file an SAR with appropriate authorities. Please contact me at your earliest convenience to further discuss these matters. That's it. A copy of your original letter is attached and a copy of the return card from the post office. The letter was signed for by someone named Natalie, and I can't read the last name. Begins with an L.
I leaned back in my leather executive chair and smiled at them, while rolling a paperclip over my fingers like a magician. Aronson, eager to impress, jumped in first.
So, Bondurant was covering his ass. He had to have known what ALOFT was doing. The banks have a wink-wink relationship with all these foreclosure mills. They don't care how it's done, they just want it done. But by sending this letter, he was distancing himself from ALOFT and the underhanded practices.
I shrugged as if to say, maybe. Arrangement and understanding, I said. They both looked at me blankly. That's what he said in the letter, unless we come to some sort of arrangement and understanding.
Okay, what's it mean? Aronson asked.
Read between the lines. I don't think he was distancing himself. I think the letter was a threat. I think it means he wanted a piece of ALOFT's action. He wanted in, and he was covering his ass, yes, by sending the letter. But I think there was another message. He wanted some of the action, or he was going to take it away from Aparicio. He was even threatening to file an SAR.
What exactly is an SAR?
Aronson asked. Suspicious activity report, Sisko said. A routine form. The banks filed them over anything.
With who?
Federal Trade, FBI, Secret Service, whoever they want to, really. I could tell I had not sold them on anything yet. Do you have any idea what sort of money ALOFT is raking in? I asked. It's easily involved in a third of our cases. I know it's unscientific, but if you take that out across the board, and ALOFT's got a third of the cases in L.A. County, then you were talking about millions and millions in fees from this one county. They say that in California alone, there will be 3 million foreclosures before this plays out over the next few years. Plus, there's the acquisition.
What acquisition? Aronson asked.
You gotta read the papers. Aparicio is in the process of selling ALOFT to a big investment fund, a company called Lemur. It's publicly traded, and any sort of controversy regarding one of its satellite acquisitions could affect the deal as well as the stock price. So don't kid yourself. If Bondurant was desperate enough, he could make some waves. He may have made more than he was counting on. Sisko nodded, the first to tumble to my theory. Okay, so we have Bondurant facing personal financial disaster, he said. Three balloons about to pop. So he turns around and tries to muscle in on Aparicio, the Lemur deal, and the whole foreclosure gravy train, and it gets him killed. That's right. Sisko was sold. I now swiveled in my chair, so that I was looking directly at Aronson.
I don't know, she said. It's a big jump, and it's going to be hard to prove.
Who says we have to prove it? We just have to figure out how to get it before the jury. The reality was we didn't need to prove a damn thing. We only had to suggest it and let a jury do the rest. I just had to plant seeds of reasonable doubt to build the hypothesis of innocence. I leaned forward across my big wooden desk and looked at my team. This is our defense theory. Aparizio is our straw man. He's the guy we paint as guilty. The jury points the finger at him, and our client walks. I looked at both their faces and got no reaction. I kept going. Sisko, I want you to focus on Louis Aparizio and his company. Get me everything that's out there. History, known associates, everything. All the details of the merger. I want to know more about that deal and this guy than even he knows. By the end of next week, I want to subpoena records from Aloft. They'll fight it, but it ought to stir things up a bit. Aronson shook her head.
But wait a minute, she said. Are you saying this is all bullshit? Just a defense gambit, and this guy Aparizio didn't really do it? What if we're right about Aparizio and they're wrong about Lisa Trammell? What if she's innocent?
She looked at me with eyes full of naive hope. I smiled and looked at Sisko. Tell her. My investigator turned to face my young associate. Kid, you're new at this, so you get a pass. But we never ask that question. It doesn't matter if our clients are guilty or innocent. They all get the same bang for the buck.
Yes, but...
There are no buts, I said. We are talking about avenues of defense here. Ways to provide our client with the best defense possible. These are strategies we will follow, regardless of guilt or innocence. You want to do criminal defense? This is what you have to understand. You never ask your client if he did it. Yes or no, the answer is only a distraction, so you don't need to know. She tightened her lips into a thin, straight line. How are you on Tennyson? I asked. The charge of the Light Brigade. What is... Theirs is not to reason why. Theirs is but to do or die. We're the Light Brigade, Bullocks. We go up against an army that has more people, more weapons, more everything. Most of the time it amounts to little more than a suicide run. No chance of survival. No chance of winning. But sometimes, you get a case where you have a shot. It might be a long shot, but it's a shot nonetheless. So you take it. You charge. And you don't ask questions like that.
Actually, I think it's do and die. That was the point of the poem. They didn't have the choice to do or die. They had to do and die.
So you know you're Tennyson. I like do or die better. The point is, did Lisa Trammell kill Mitchell Bondurant? I really don't know. She says she didn't, and that's good enough for me. If it's not good enough for you, then I'll take you off this one and put you back on foreclosures full time.
No, Aronson said quickly. I want to stay. I'm in.
That's good. Not many lawyers get to sit second chair on a murder case 10 months out of law school. She looked at me, eyes wide.
Second chair?
I nodded.
You deserve it. You've done some really good work on this.
But the light quickly faded.
What? I just don't know why you can't have it both ways. You know, give unbridled effort in your defense, but be conscientious about your work. Try for the best outcome.
The best outcome for who? Your client? Society? Or for yourself? Your responsibility is to your client and the law, Bullocks. That's it. I gave her a long stare before continuing. Don't go growing a conscience on me, I said. I've been down that road. It doesn't lead you to anything good. Chapter 10. After spending most of the day setting up the office, I didn't get home till almost 8. I found my ex-wife sitting on the steps leading up to the front deck. Our daughter wasn't with her. In the past year, there had been several encounters between us that did not include Haley, and I was thrilled by the aspect of another. I was dog-tired from the day's mental and physical work, but I could easily rally for Maggie McPherce. Hey, Mags, you forget the key? She got up, and just from her stiff posture and the way she dusted off the backside of her jeans all businesslike, I knew something wasn't right. When I got to the top step, I moved in for a kiss, just on the cheek. But she immediately made an evasive maneuver, and my suspicion was confirmed. That's where Haley gets it, I said. The old duck and roll when I give her a kiss.
Well, I'm not here for that, Holler, I didn't use my key because I thought you might consider it some sort of conflict of interest if you found a prosecutor in your house.
Now I got it. Yoga today? You saw Andrea Freeman?
That's right.
Suddenly I didn't feel the strength to rally anymore. I unlocked the door like a prisoner punished with the indignity of letting himself into the room where they give you the needle. Come on in. I guess we'll get this over with. She came in quickly, my last comment throwing another log on her fire.
What you did was despicable, using our daughter in such an underhanded way.
I wheeled around on her. Using our daughter? I did no such thing. Our daughter was put in the middle of this thing, and I only learned of it by accident.
It doesn't matter. You're disgusting.
No, I'm a defense lawyer, and your good pal Andy was discussing me and my case with my ex-wife in front of my daughter. And then she outright lied to me.
What are you talking about? She doesn't lie.
I'm not talking about Haley. I'm talking about Andy. I asked her on the first day she was on the case if she knew you, and she said she knew you only in passing. I think we can agree that that is not the case. And I don't know for sure, but I would guess that if we described this situation to 10 different judges, that maybe 10 would consider it a conflict.
Look, we weren't discussing you or the case. It came up when we were having lunch. Haley happened to be there. What am I supposed to do? Disavow my friends because of you? It doesn't work that way.
If it was no big deal, why did she lie to me?
It wasn't a direct lie. It's not like we're best friends or anything. Besides, she probably didn't want you to get into it like you have anyway.
So now we're qualifying lies on a sliding scale. Some are indirect and no big deal. Don't worry about those lies.
Holler, don't be an asshole.
Look, you want something to drink?
I don't want anything. I came to tell you that you not only embarrassed me and your daughter, but yourself.
It was low, Holler.
You used something innocent from your own daughter to get an edge. It was really low.
I was still holding my briefcase. I put it down on the table in the dining alcove. I put my hands on the top of one of the chairs and leaned down on it as I thought out my comeback.
Come on,
Maggie said, baiting me. You always have a quick answer for everything. The great defender. Let's hear it this time. I laughed and shook my head. She was so damn beautiful when she was mad. It was disarming. And the bad part was, I think she knew it.
Oh, so this is funny. You threatened to ruin someone's career and then can laugh about it.
I didn't threaten to ruin her career. I threatened to kick her off the case. And no, it's not funny. It's just that...
What, Holler? It's just that what? I've been sitting out there for 2 hours, wondering if you were going to show up because I want to know how you could do this.
I stepped away from the table and went on the offensive, moving toward her as I spoke, making her step back and then crowding her into a corner, ending my words with my finger pointing inches from her chest. I did it because I'm a defense attorney, and as a defense attorney, I have taken an oath to defend my clients to the best of my ability. So yes, I saw an advantage here. Your good pal Andy and you clearly crossed a line. Sure, no harm was done, as far as I know. But that doesn't mean the line wasn't crossed. If you jump a fence with a sign on it that says no trespassing, then you were still trespassing, even if you jump right back across. So I became aware of this trespass, and I used it to my advantage to get something I need to defend my client. Something I should have been given as a matter of course, but which your friend was holding back simply because she could. Was she within the rules? Yes. Was it fair? No. And one reason you're all hot and bothered about it is that you know it wasn't fair and that I made the right move. It was something you would have done yourself.
Never in a million years. I would never stoop so low.
Bullshit. I turned away from her. She stayed in the corner. What are you doing here, Maggie?
What do you mean? I just told you why I'm here.
Yeah, but you could have picked up a phone or sent me an email. Why did you come here?
I wanted to see your face when you gave an explanation.
I turned back to her. The whole thing was a sideshow. I moved in on her and put my hand on the wall right next to her head. It was bullshit arguments like this that wrecked our marriage, I said.
I know.
You know, it's been 8 years. We've been divorced as long as we were married. 8 years, and I still couldn't shake her.
8 years, and here we are.
Yes, here we are.
You know, you're the trespasser, Holler. You jump over everybody's fences. Come in and out of our lives whenever you want. And we just let you.
I slowly leaned in closer until we were breathing the same air. I kissed her lightly, and then harder when she tried to say something. I didn't want to hear any more words. I was finished with words.
Part 2. The Hypothesis of Innocence. Chapter 11. The office was closed and locked for the evening, but I was still in place at my desk, prepping for the preliminary hearing. It was a Tuesday in early March, and I wished I could have opened a window to let in the cool evening breeze, but the office was hermetically sealed with vertical windows that did not open. Lorna hadn't noticed that when she'd inspected the place and signed the lease. It made me miss working out of the back seat of the Lincoln, where I could slide a window down and catch the breeze whenever I wanted. The preliminary hearing was a week away. By prepping, I mean I was trying to anticipate what my opponent, Andrea Freeman, would be willing to part with when she put her case before the judge. A preliminary hearing is a routine step on the way to a trial. It is 100% the prosecution's show. The state is charged with presenting its case to the court, and the judge then rules on whether there is sufficient evidence to take it forward to a jury trial. This isn't the reasonable doubt threshold. Not even close. The judge only has to decide if a preponderance of the evidence supports the charges. If so, then the next stop is a full-blown trial. The trick for Freeman would be to parcel out just enough evidence to cross that preponderance line and get the judge's nod of approval without giving away the whole store. Because she knew that I would be going to school on whatever she presented. There is no doubt that the prosecution's burden is no burden at all. Though the idea of a preliminary hearing is to provide a check on the system and to make sure the government does not run roughshod over the individual, it is still a fixed game. The California State Assembly saw to that. Frustrated by the seemingly interminable duration of criminal cases as they slowly wound through the justice system, the politicians in Sacramento took action. The prevailing view was that justice delayed was justice denied, never mind that this sentiment conflicted with a basic component of the adversarial system, a strong and vigorous defense. The Assembly sidestepped that minor inconvenience and voted for change, installing measures that streamlined the process. The preliminary hearing went from a full airing of the prosecution's evidence to what is essentially a game of hide-and-seek. Few witnesses had to be called besides the lead investigator, hearsay was approved rather than discouraged, and the prosecution need not offer even half of its evidence, just enough to get by. The result was that it was beyond rare that a case did not measure up to the level of preponderance, and the preliminary hearing became a routine rubber stamping of the charges on the way to trial. Still, there was a value for the defense in the proceedings. I still got a peek at what was to come, and I would still get an opportunity to raise questions about what witnesses and evidence were presented. And therein was the prep work. I needed to anticipate which cards Freeman would show, and decide how I would play against them. We were way past any notion of a plea agreement. Freeman still wasn't giving on that end, and my client still wasn't taking. We were on a direct course toward a trial in April or May, and I can't say I was unhappy about it. We had a legitimate shot, and if Lisa Trammell wanted to go for it, I was going to be ready. In recent weeks, we had gotten some good news as well as bad on the evidence front. As expected, Judge Morales ruled against our motions to suppress the police interview and the search of Lisa's home. This cleared the way for the prosecution to build its case around the pillars of motivation, opportunity, and the single eyewitness account. They had the foreclosure action. They had Lisa's history of protest against the bank. They had her incriminating admissions during her interview. And most of all, they had the eyewitness, Margot Schaefer, who claimed to have seen Lisa just a block from the bank and only minutes after the killing. but we were building a defense case that attacked these pillars and contained much evidence that was indeed exculpatory. No murder weapon had been identified or found yet, and the state's zeal to prove that a tiny blemish of blood found on a pipe wrench taken from the tool bench in Lisa's garage had backfired when testing concluded it was not